We're about to have a conversation with Ron Cassie, who is the senior editor of Baltimore Magazine and author of the major article in this issue of Baltimore Magazine called A Tale of Two Cities. For a half a century, West Baltimore was a vital center of black culture, mixed income neighborhoods, and groundbreaking civil rights activism. After Freddie Gray, Can It Be Again? Is the subtitle of A Tale of Two Cities. And Ron, good to see you again. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's just begin. This is interesting. You start the article off. I didn't know where this was going to go, but it's a great historical piece about the battle. And we just recently had conversations with on the air with Dr. Lawrence Brown about Baltimore being the victim of all these racist policies for the last 105 years, which led us to the moment of Freddie Gray, which I thought was a really interesting arc that he built for us. And so you do some of that in this article, too, which I really, really appreciate. But you start by talking about Tommy Rodas, the soldier who was killed by a Baltimore City cop and the march that ensued that few people know about in 1942.
Right. So to start with that story, the reason was, for me, was that it hit a lot of buttons. It's a complicated story. First of all, this is a U.S. Army private who on leave is going to, from Fort Meade, is going to Pennsylvania Avenue to the Royal Theater, where he can hear Louis Armstrong. At the same time, that's possible. It's also possible that he'll be shot to death that night by a white police officer because he's trying to get a cab. And that's the complex, I think, nature. We don't want to romanticize Pennsylvania Avenue. You know, it was segregated West Baltimore. At the same time, it was this epicenter of black culture.
It was happening place.
At the same time, it was this epicenter of black culture and music. You know, this is where Jay-Z or Beyonce today would be playing, right? It was still a dangerous time to be a black citizen in Baltimore. You know, it was segregated. There was no black police officers on the police force. You know, there was tough living conditions still. So you know, there's obviously a through line from Thomas Brodus to Freddie Gray in terms of police brutality. He was the 10th African-American killed in the previous 3 years.
In 1942.
And
then there were fewer black folks in Baltimore than there are now, percentage-wise, in terms of the population.
Absolutely. And the city was a tinderbox, according to reporting from the Afro-American at the time. And as you know, Lillie Mae Carroll-Jackson.
Leader of the NAACP and...
Right.
And the grandma of the Mitchell clan.
Right.
Right.
Organized. I mean, there was, much like after Freddie Gray, there was an uprising. There were marches and protests and demonstrations and calls for action beyond just police or, justice reform, wider calls. So that's why that story reverberated so much with me to start with Thomas Brodus.
But you also said before we walked in, it's interesting because I first learned of Thomas Brodus when the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown was on the show, and he brought the Brodus case up on the air, and we talked about it a few years back when he came on the program. And it's an interesting case because very few people know about it. And the march that took place in Annapolis, which actually took place in April, the month of Freddie Gray.
Right.
But there's also that through line to me is this month of April and all the things happened between the rebellion of 68 and Brodus, the march on Annapolis, Freddie Gray, obviously. And then in 1861, it was the scene when the white mobs attacked free blacks and Union soldiers coming through town in April of 1861 at the beginning of the Civil War. Right. So there's something about this month of April that had this kind of, as you call it, through line.
Yeah, something with the spring. You know, I covered education in the city for a while, and it seemed like things would start to happen after, you know, the winter was over and the schools as well. Yeah, I guess I was telling you beforehand, and this did not make it into the story, which is, you know, probably my failure as a writer, but I actually interviewed two of Thomas Brodus's children, Shirley Brodus, his daughter, who's in her late 70s now, and Thomas Brodus, who is in his mid-70s. Two of his three children survived. So 1942 to me is not an ancient story. Two of this man's children survived today. The only family picture that survives of their father is actually the photo of his casket that was published in the Afro. Their mother never remarried. Their mother had come down for an initial hearing before the charges were dropped against the police officer who killed her husband. She never remarried. She couldn't talk about her husband. You know, he would have grandchildren today who have never met their grandfather. This stuff reverberates through generations. It's not a one-time thing. And they know his children are in mid and late 70s. They know about Michael Garner. They know about Walter Scott, Eric Garner, Walter Scott. And they didn't realize their father. You know, there was a similar uprising after his death.
So it's interesting you found the family and the fact that you were talking about that the grandkids who knew about Garner and know about all the other people.
His kids.
Right.
His children who are 75 and like 78 today. Two of his kids, you know, are aware that with cell phone videos of the Walter Scotts, the Eric Garners, and did not realize their father was one of these individuals who was killed by police in a similar circumstance. They didn't really know the full story.
So how did the kids and grandkids
react
to
that? There was an uprising afterwards. There was marches to Annapolis after their father's death. I was talking to some family members on the phone, and they were Googling their grandfather or their half-father's name while I'm talking to them on the phone, discovering this new information about him. You know, gratefully, the Afro-American archives are online now. I think they were kind of taken aback, shell-shocked, that they didn't know this story. It's just coming to light, really. So I guess it's not just a Baltimore story.
No, it's not. I mean, it's absolutely, unfortunately, a universal story in this world. And I think that was very interesting. You decided to kind of pick that piece in the fact that there are no pictures of Brodus, which I found interesting as well, you said to me. And you it's good that you go into 1968 and how 68 was, and comparing 68 to where we are now, which is important because they were very different instances, but both, I think, really deeply important instances in terms of our history. So I'm curious what happened to you in the course of this article. I mean, you've been covering stuff for a while. You obviously have a deep interest in issues that affect the black community. You have deep interest in civil rights issues. So I'm curious what affected you by the article you wrote on Tale of Two Cities.
Well, I was up in Penn North during the night of the curfew up there, and this story was really like a year in process, and it changed over time. And, you know, I'd say personally what happened to me was, you know, you're looking at these crumbling buildings in West Baltimore as you're learning about this history. And the people who live in West Baltimore, they know the history. Even if they're young, their parents, their grandparents, they know Pennsylvania Avenue, they know the civil rights leaders. And as you're learning this history by reporting and continuing to meet people, and I went to Sheila Gaskins has written a play called Last House Standing. I've been to two readings of that, right? You know, amazing. And so as you kept learning more and more, the question was, like, you know, what the hell happened? You know, the single most powerful thing to me was probably talking to Thomas Brodus's two children, you know, because they're essentially my mother's age, you know, I knew all my grandparents and very close to my family. And to think that not only did they never know their father, that their children never knew their grandfather, and this just reverberates through generations.
Nor the story.
That made it very personal to speak to them. But you know, the transition from the 1968 story, the other thing was simply that I think this story gets painted as, you know, there was riots in 1968 and then white people left and then now we have this. And that's not the story. That's not accurate. So it became about just trying to understand more what happened. And I think anybody from Baltimore, when you learn about the stories of Reverend Harvey Johnson or Irene Morgan,
right.
You know, you can't help but be moved by these powerful stories.
One of the things you talk about in here, and I think that it's really a powerful history and I think important, especially for everybody to know, but it's really especially for your readers to know, are the stories of people like the paragraph you have about Reverend Harvey Johnson, that a uniquely powerful human being, and then helping create the NAACP and the Niagara Movement right here from Baltimore, Irene Morgan, who predated Rosa Parks. I mean, and you covered these things. Talk a bit about that.
I knew a little bit about Reverend Harvey Johnson, who is really, even though Frederick Douglass was a Baltimorean, lived here, Reverend Harvey Johnson is that kind of individual in American history. He was born into slavery in Northern Virginia. His parents are freed, and eventually he makes his way through college and the seminary through being born into slavery. And eventually takes the reins as a young man at Union Church, which becomes Union Baptist Church, which still exists today in West Baltimore, where Reverend Alvin Hathaway
right
leads. And his congregation grows from like 200 to over 2,000. He is that kind of leader. And he begins an organization called the Mutual Brotherhood of Liberty, which is a predecessor to Niagara Movement and a predecessor to the NAACP. And he knew W.E.D. Du Bois.
Out of Baltimore. This is what I'm putting.
Out of Baltimore.
Right.
Baltimore's history gets lost, I think, as people have talked about before, because we are on just below the Mason-Dixon line. But we're the largest segregated city in the South. And because it happened first, I think because it was a mix of North and South in Baltimore, its civil rights stories get lost or been marginalized or untold somewhat in the past. Everything happened in the city very much at the forefront of the civil rights movement, especially early on. So Reverend Harvey Johnson is going to take a train from Baltimore to Harper's Ferry for an early NAACP meeting in 1906, and he's told he can't he has to sit in a segregated car, which he refuses to do in 1906. And eventually he nonetheless makes his way to this meeting, according to all the available sources. And he leads a fight because the federal laws prohibited segregation. If you were traveling across state, and this is why Irene Morgan eventually wins her case, well, and why Thurgood Marshall wins the case, mm-hmm. right, who is in this neighborhood as well, from this neighborhood, is that there was laws against segregation, in, you know, federal laws against segregation. So if you're on an interstate bus or interstate train. And this is one way that segregation slowly gets dismantled over time. It's, I guess, another story maybe that gets untold. But Brown versus the Board of Education doesn't happen in a vacuum, right? And the civil rights laws don't happen in a vacuum. There's steps. And these were two big early steps. Reverend Harvey Johnson battle over sitting in the train, segregated compartment, gets wins the civil rights battle eventually. And Irene Morgan is a working mother of two from Baltimore who is going to visit her mother in Virginia. She had recently had a miscarriage and was on a bus and was sitting in the black section of the bus in Virginia. And as the bus continued through Virginia on its way to Baltimore, the bus got more and more crowded, according to the story. And eventually the bus driver came back and said, you have to move further back. So sitting in the black section wasn't enough. She had to move further back. And it's just one of those very human moments where somebody has reached their tipping point and says, mm-hmm. that's enough. I've had it. You know, I'm a working mother of two. I've just had a miscarriage. I'm visiting my mother. And I'm sitting in the black section. Now you're saying I got to move a couple rows back further. And that's when she says, you're going to have to arrest me now. I've had it. You know, which I think is just a very human moment, right? Now you're going to have to arrest me. And initially, I guess he writes her a ticket and she tears it up and throws it back at him and she gets hauled off the bus and arrested. And eventually Thurgood Marshall breaks down this interstate segregated law in terms of busing. So
I think it's really important, realizing this is all out of Baltimore and how places like the Royal Theater and the role that it played and all that, the people who played there from Calloway on down to Aretha Franklin and James Brown. I mean, it was, and many people, many people in the large metropolitan area don't know this story.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, that's another component of this piece was to watching the national media like we all do in Baltimore. West Baltimore has been painted with this brush in the past year of a violent place, of vacant houses, of poverty. And, I did also want to tell that story that this is really one of the most compelling neighborhoods in the United States, one of the most consequential histories in the United States. It was once every bit the entertainment center that Harlem was, that U Street in D.C. was, right. And that's this neighborhood, and this is exactly where Freddie Gray is arrested and bounced around the back of a van.
And, I was interested in the map that you had in here from 1911 and the other pieces like that you had in here, because it was, if you do, which we did in a class that my producer, Stephanie Mambronis, and I are teaching at UMBC at the moment, you take the map you have here of the residential security map, the map that segregated places in Baltimore legally, that if you do an overlay of this map with other maps and you see this is where the redlining took place, same overlay, this is where most of the arrests take place, where most people are incarcerated takes place, where most of the food deserts take place, now where most of the abandoned houses are. The map hasn't changed.
Yeah, parts of Sandtown and Upton and Druid Heights, the the